The United States Court of International Trade is now in session. The Honorable Mark A. Barnett presiding before court number 20-00007, Carbon Activated Tin Engine Company Limited et al. Versus the United States. Will the attorneys please state their names for the record, starting with the plaintiff?
Yes, good morning, Your Honor. Jordan Kahn with the law firm Grunfeld Desiderio, representing plaintiffs and plaintiff interveners. With me from my law firm Grunfeld Desiderio is my colleague Dharmendra Chowdhury.
Morning.
Good morning. My name is Molly Finnan on behalf of the United States defendant. With me on by telephone is Commerce Counsel Ian McInerney.
Okay. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa Brewer of Kelly Dry and Warren on behalf of defendant interveners.
Okay, good morning, everyone. So as you all know, the court issued a series of questions last week. I think most of you have appeared before me before. As you know, when we do questions, what I'd like to do is basically start with those questions and focus on those at least at the outset. I've read all your briefs. There's certainly no need to repeat the arguments that you made in your briefs. To a fair degree, many of the questions are focused on factual issues, issues where there's a question whether there's substantial evidence in the record that either the government failed to take account of, or that there is a lack of evidence in the record to support a position that's being advocated before the court. So I'd like to focus in particularly in those questions where it is just a straight up factual question. It's not a need to get into an excessive amount of argument. I mean, if I'm looking for a citation in some of these, you know, if you just give me the citation and we can move on. On each question, I will start with, I mean, there's sort of an obvious addressee to the question. For example, most of the surrogate country selection questions are directed in the first instance to the government. So we'll start with the government on those questions, and then we'll give the plaintiffs an opportunity to respond to the answer provided by the government to the extent that there's any need to provide further information. Give defendant interveners, obviously, an opportunity to comment on each one. But I think a lot of these we can move forward and move through fairly expeditiously, which is what I'd like to do. At the end of that process, to the extent that any party feels that they have additional issues that they need to raise and address for the benefit of the court, we'll give you an opportunity to do that. But again, whether it's in response to questions or at the end there, I would encourage not to repeat arguments that you've all made in your briefs. Again, we're familiar with those, and the goal is to really facilitate decision-making process moving forward without additional repetition. So without that, without further ado, unless there's any questions that anybody has, you'll see me occasionally just so you know how I'm operating here. I'm actually operating off of two different screens. I am logged into this twice. So I have the benefit of whoever's arguing right in front of me with on a laptop view. So I'll get the full benefit of your argument, but I've also got everybody in a gallery view in the background on a separate monitor so that if somebody needs to wave because they can't hear or some other issue has arisen, hopefully we can spot that fairly expeditiously and resolve the issue. So with that, let me start with the questions. I'm not going to read the questions into the record. We've got them on the record. They're all docketed, and we'll just try to move through them again as expeditiously as possible. Start off with question 1A. As I mentioned, the surrogate country selection questions are, I think, largely directed to the government in the first instance. So Ms. Finnan, if you want to jump in there with regard to question 1A, and again, just for clarity, we'll go question by question, giving each party an opportunity to comment in direct response to each question.
Yes, Your Honor. So this is Molly Finnan on behalf of the United States. In regards to the court's first question, 1A, record evidence of Commerce's analysis of exports of comparable merchandise can be found at PDM, Preliminary Decision Memorandum 14 and 15, as well as the Issues and Decision Memorandum at 7 through 8 and Note 34. Note 34, in turn, refers to record evidence at the Respondent's Surrogate Country Comments, PR 99, at Exhibit 1.
Okay. Well, I'm actually going to jump ahead before I give my pilot. Having just explained how I'm going to do it, I'm going to create an exception to that process and jump right ahead to 1B, because, I mean, I did look, for example, at page 7, footnote 34 of the IND memo, and the problem is, I mean, there's the discussion in the text is that they looked at, for example, value and volume, and that they looked at that Malaysia was a producer of comparable merchandise. And so what's in the footnote, the support, the evidentiary support there speaks only to the two volume. It doesn't address value, and it speaks to volume of, it's characterized as subject merchandise, presumably identical merchandise, rather than comparable merchandise. And so this is what we're really trying to get at here is, you know, where's the full-throated basis for this analysis?
Yes, Your Honor. I'll see if I can clarify. So Commerce's decisions with respect to significant production are explicitly stated with respect to export volume, and that refers back to the data at PR 99, the Global Trade Atlas data of export volumes during the period of review. At that data, it provides that Malaysia had an export quantity during the period of review of a little over 16.4 million kilograms. With respect to value,
it was a gross volume, not a net volume, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
So, yeah. Go ahead.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
That's all right. Go ahead.
Commerce acknowledged that none of the listed countries from the Office of Policy listed potential surrogates were net exporters of merchandise. If that's where your question was going. So Commerce turned to looking at gross exports. And as I mentioned, Malaysia's for the period of review was 16.475 million kilograms. Romania, in contrast, was 34,000 kilograms. They're turning to value. Commerce does not explicitly reason significant production based on the value of gross exports. To some extent, its analysis in that regard could be inferred from the record because it was looking at data that contained both gross exports in terms of volume and gross exports in terms of value. But even if the court were to find that a value-based conclusion is not present in the record, it doesn't change the substantial evidence supporting Commerce's decision based on gross exports by volume. Does that get to what the court was asking?
To a degree, I think within the confines, or let me say the limitations, I think, of what Commerce actually did. I mean, I think that's the challenge here. Let me then pause and go back. I mean, rather than sort of follow up, I mean, I think in some respects, 1D is going to be relevant to this discussion as well, and we'll get to that in due course. But let me give counsel for plaintiffs, I don't know, Mr. Khan, you're going to go ahead.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor.
Feel free to address both 1A and B.
Okay. With the court's indulgence, I'd like to share my screen. We practiced this, so let's make sure that it works. Mm-hmm. Okay. Are people seeing my screen?
Nope.
No.
Here we go.
Okay. So I just, what's really important here, and defendant just referenced that the analysis, the question 1A is where is the analysis? The analysis is only in the preliminary decision memo at 14, and I've highlighted the analysis, and it does, you know, it cites our comments that we submitted on October 12, 2018 for, you know, these export, these net gross export volumes. There's nothing about value, and as a defendant's counsel just recognized, right, there's values here for Malaysia, also 34,000 kg for Romania, as she stated. But what's really critical here is this, this is the only finding on the record with respect to these data, is that Commerce preliminary determines that none of the total export volumes from these countries identified in this SC memo are insignificant. Accordingly, Commerce finds that all of these countries, including Romania, are significant producers of comparable merchandise pursuant to the statute. So that's the preliminary analysis. And then turning to the IDM, this is what defendant's counsel was just talking about, page 7 and footnote 34 in the final, they do again note those same export volumes, right? Again, no value, but the 34,000 Romanian kg plus all the others. And they do say we analyze exports of comparable merchandise from the six countries as a proxy, but there's no new analysis. There's certainly no new analysis to say, well, now only Malaysia is a significant producer, because the only analysis was from the prelim. They haven't readdressed that. And so what we think is going on here, Your Honor, is that the government is making a post hoc assertion that export data on the record support Commerce's final surrogate country selection. And just to put a fine point on this, this is page 16 of the government's brief, and we've highlighted Commerce reasonably concluded that Romania's exports by value and quantity were too small to reflect significant production on this record. I mean, this is clearly post hoc. First, they cite our data submission, not Commerce findings. They cite value, which defendant just concede Commerce didn't reference anywhere on the record. And this is very interesting, is that for quantity, defendant just said that it was correctly that it was 34,000 kg, but here in their brief, they say it was only 3,051 kg. And what's clear that happened, if I can go to what they're citing, which is our October 12, 2018 submission exhibit one, we see that defendant has in a post hoc capacity looked at our data and is drawing its own conclusion at value, which they got correct, quantity, which they got wrong, right? 3051 is $3,051 per U.S. ton. That's the AUV. The quantity is 34,000 kg. So here we have a post hoc assertion that's wrong, but even if it were correct, you know, it's axiomatic that the agency's decision needs to be espoused below, that it can't be done on, you know, before this court in the first instance. So if I can stop sharing my screen and just kind of wrap up by addressing 1B, which is, again, Commerce did not invoke export data to support its final. They didn't revisit their preliminary finding that all countries were significant producers of comparable merchandise, including both Malaysia and Romania. And so we urge this court not to sanction the post hoc assertion by counsel. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Brewer, anything you want to add?
At this point, the government has covered everything we plan to say on this issue.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. We'll return to Ms. Finnan then for 1C about the practice preferences of Commerce. Oh, sorry, you're on mute yet.
Apologies. If I may start with a general observation, Commerce's analysis of significant production in this case is not a model of clarity. Okay, so to the extent the government's brief goes back to record evidence to show the manner in which Commerce may have reached its ultimate determination does not amount per se to a post hoc rationalization. That said, Commerce's decision is not a model of clarity, but we do submit it is supported by substantial evidence. on the court's question 1C, the court inquires whether or not Commerce has a preference for evidence of production of identical rather than comparable merchandise. Yes, Commerce has such a preference. It is found in the policy bulletin at 0.04.1 at page 2 and note 6. Page 2 of the policy bulletin provides, quote, in all cases, if identical merchandise is produced, the country qualifies as a producer of comparable merchandise. In cases where the identical merchandise is not produced, Commerce must determine if other merchandise that is comparable is produced. How Commerce does this depends on the subject merchandise. And then note 6 goes on to provide, if considering a producer of identical merchandise leads to data difficulties, then the operations team may consider countries that produce a broader category of reasonably comparable merchandise. So yes, as a general matter, in answer to the court's question, Commerce does have a preference for producers of identical merchandise, but that preference comes into play in terms of the data quality issues, not in terms of significant production. And so I wanted to add that nuance in answer to the question, because the question itself is not specific one way or the other.
Okay, then there's a second subpart there about significance.
Yeah, so with respect to the second subpart, the court is inquiring whether where Commerce analyzes, question two asks on what basis did Commerce consider production of identical merchandise by three Malaysian companies to be significant for purposes of section 1677B. Commerce did not conclude that Malaysia's production was significant by virtue of there being three Malaysian financial statements on the record. Commerce did consider Malaysia to be a significant producer of identical merchandise based on the Global Trade Atlas data and UN Comtrade data that we earlier discussed in the answer to the court's question one. That's the data at attachment one in PR 99. Commerce did, however, as the court, I think, notes, did look to the fact that there were three financial statements from Malaysia on the record, and did conclude in the issues and decision memorandum at pages 7 and 8 that the fact that those three financial statements were on the record did provide, quote, stronger evidence of the production of the subject merchandise. The existence of the three financial statements was relevant to establishing that Malaysia was a producer of the identical merchandise. It was not a basis for concluding that with the understanding it was a producer of the subject merchandise, that it was also a significant producer.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, why don't we, maybe before we'll do similarly to the way we combined A and B and sort of, and I think rolled D into this as well, because it's related particularly to that sub-question too, and that is the mm-hmm. the context in which the department analyzes significant production. I mean, this you mentioned earlier that this decision was probably not a model of clarity. And I think one of the challenges is with respect to activated carbon that the agency has a history of being less than clear in its analysis of significant production. And in some cases, when it's pushed to actually go through the steps that it claims it goes through in each case to determine a significant production, when it, you know, upon closer examination, it ends up having to adjust its determination. And we seem to have a similar situation here. I mean, where Commerce took nothing more than gross export volume. I mean, there's a reference to value, but there's no analysis of value. There's a reference to comparable at one point, but it's not clear that they moved beyond identical. And they simply attached a conclusion to that of significant production. And I think Mr. Khan points out fairly that, you know, it's a decision that changed between prelim and final without the benefit of any actual additional analysis that's apparent to the court. I mean, are we missing something here? Where's the, you know, I mean, I had to send prior reviews back to the agency as well, because they didn't look at, okay, you know, where they say they're going to look at it in the context of world production, things like, I mean, this is not the court creating standards and for the agency to apply. This is the agency apparently not applying its own standards here. Help me find, is there something that we're missing with respect to the agency's analysis in this case?
Yes, Your Honor, I'll try my best in that regard. So I think there's a couple of things going on here. One important thing to note, I believe, is that no party in the administrative review was challenging whether the listed countries, specifically Romania and Malaysia, were significant producers of comparable merchandise. So to the extent that mitigates for the court any harm in the lack of analysis on Commerce's part, we do think it's relevant that no party was actually challenging significant production here.
In some ways, it actually, rather than mitigate, it makes it worse, though, because that means Commerce altered its preliminary decision on its own without the benefit of any explanation. I mean, it's one thing when Commerce has an inadequate explanation but makes a change based on arguments by a party, whether it's petitioner or respondent, because you can at least have some possible ability to infer that it was a result of an analysis of that party's comments. Mm-hmm. Here, we've got nothing. We've got a blank slate and an alteration by the agency.
So with respect to that alteration, Your Honor, I'll start with an apology out front on behalf of the United States. The government's brief talks about how Commerce determined in the final that Romania was not a significant producer of comparable merchandise. And some of that also stems from plaintiff's opening brief, which construed the IDM to find that Romania was not a significant producer of comparable merchandise. Going back to my earlier comment that the IDM is not a model of clarity, in review of the briefs and in prep for this argument, I spend a lot of time with that IDM again. And there is no clear statement from Commerce one way or the other that I can find in the IDM that says definitively Commerce continues to believe Romania is a significant producer of comparable merchandise, or the contrary proposition that Commerce now has determined to depart from the preliminary results and find that Romania is no longer a significant producer of comparable merchandise. Instead, what I think can best be gleaned from the IDM that Commerce acknowledged that in its preliminary results, it found Romania was a significant producer of comparable merchandise. And then between the preliminary and the final, looked further at the record, considered the party's arguments, what have you, and noted that with the single Romcarbon financial statement on the record, that single statement called the conclusion with regards to significant production into question. Unfortunately, IDM, I think, doesn't take it that one step further, as we all might have appreciated, in either concluding definitively it was a significant producer or wasn't a significant producer, but instead goes on to talk about data quality. And so in that regard, I think Commerce's analysis is more fulsome, that the data quality attending Malaysian data was, in Commerce's view, the best available relative to the single financial statement from Romania on the record. I think that's relevant in that perhaps the parties are going down the wrong path in arguing back and forth about the intricacies of whether or not Romania is or is not a significant producer, because at the end of the day, Commerce isn't fully analyze the fact, its view, that data quality supports the selection of Malaysia. So whether Romania is or is not a significant producer of comparable merchandise, at the end of the day, we would submit that Commerce's determination to select Malaysia as the primary surrogate is still supported by substantial evidence, not contrary to law.
But it needs to be, before you get to data quality, you need to first have that finding that they are a significant producer. And I think that's where, I would bring you back to the question 1B and just ask, is there, Is there some place in the record that we're missing where the agency performs the analysis that it claims it is going to perform in terms of selecting the primary surrogate country and determined that they were a significant producer in the context of world production of and trade in comparable merchandise?
What I have cited to date in the PDM, the IDM, and PR99 is the sum total of Commerce's analysis.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Well, let's give plaintiffs an opportunity to jump in here. Mr. Khan, I assume you're going to continue with this one.
Yes, exactly. Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate it. So I just start off with the question about the supposed preference for identical over comparable. And before this review, we were completely unaware of any Commerce preference for identical merchandise. Policy 041 does say that a country will satisfy the statutory criterion if it makes identical merchandise. But it doesn't say that Commerce is to prefer identical over comparable and that it's supposed to stop its statutory analysis upon finding identical merchandise, right? These are different, deliberately different terms. So, you know, comparable is a broader term than identical. And, you know, any supposed Commerce practice in this regard would violate the statute because Congress deliberately chose comparable, not identical, in NME cases for surrogate value. And the rationale is that in these NME cases, Commerce is using a country to value the inputs, the factors of production. It's not valuing the end product. So there's no necessity to have identical merchandise. And you know, this is a Chevron step one. Congress said comparable, not identical. And perhaps when Commerce gets to the financial ratios, it would make sense to have a preference for identical merchandise, right? To have use statements from companies making the same thing to make sure the ratios are accurate. But for the whole surrogate value factor of production purposes, Congress deliberately required only comparable, and Commerce has contradicted this in AR11. Turning to the next question, and this is very important because I think we disagree with defendants' analysis that Commerce was somehow mum on Romania's status. I mean, this is on right out of page 8 of the IDM. The record in this case does not support a finding that Romania satisfied section 773C4B of the Act. So this is a clear Commerce finding that, you know, Romania is out of consideration. And we're not going to – there's no – Your Honor doesn't seem interested at this stage about data quality, but we have plenty to say, and we did in our briefs about Romanian data quality. But what we really object to is Romania just being knocked out of the gates based on this finding that it's not a significant producer and that, you know, only Malaysia is. And if you look at this analysis on pages 7 to 8, we've spent quite a lot of time with it as well. And all that we see coming out of this is Commerce saying, we're going to pick Malaysia because there's 3 Malaysian financial statements from activated carbon producers in Malaysia. So that's why we're going to find Malaysia to be a significant producer. Whereas Romania has just 1. So, you know, it's just 3 versus 1. There's no quantification of those 3 companies, and there's no reliance on trade data. Again, we the only analysis of that trade data on the record was the prelim, which supported the position that all countries, including Romania, satisfy the criterion, that they're all on the same footing. And so, and Commerce, in making this significance finding through a comparison, it just does this tally, right? 3 versus 1. We see that as an administrative shortcut. There's no rigorous contextualized assessment of record evidence. And importantly, this approach contradicts Commerce's policy 4.1 of not determining significance relative to the comparative production of the potential surrogate countries. So we submit remand is warranted, as this court ordered in the 7th and 8th administrative reviews of this order. And similarly, remand is also warranted for the separate basis, turning to question D, because there was no contextualization in terms of the policy 4.1 statement that the significant production judgment should be consistent with the characteristics of world production of and trade in comparable merchandise. So nowhere on the record to support Romania being excluded as a not a significant producer of comparable merchandise, nowhere is there anything about world production and trade, except for the data analysis in the prelim where Commerce made the opposite finding that Malaysia was a significant producer of comparable merchandise. So without any such reference, Commerce's selection of Malaysia avoids any requisite contextual analysis. We see this review as being on all fours with AR 7 and 8. We think it's charitable to characterize the IDM as a lack of clarity. What we see here, Your Honor, is Commerce repeatedly violating its own policy and selecting surrogate countries in a manner that's devoid of substantial evidence. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Brewer, anything you want to add to this part of the conversation?
Nothing at this point, Your Honor. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Ms. Finnan, anything further on C or D, or should we move on to E?
Only to say that respondents below did not challenge significant production in the administrative review.
Well, that's a perfect segue into E. And it's a question of exhaustion and what the Federal Circuit has addressed with regard to the issue of exhaustion in the Boomerang case. You want to jump into that discussion?
Yes, Your Honor. Question E little one poses a hypothetical. Does Boomerang require exhaustion of arguments when Commerce changes its methodology and corresponding conclusions when there has been no interested party argument on the issue? United States' position is that yes, it does. Boomerang requires exhaustion even when Commerce changes its methodology and even in the absence of party arguments on an issue. But I will add a caveat, and that is provided the parties had notice that such conclusions were feasible from the record, right? The data was on the record, the data was relevant to the issue, and the parties had an opportunity to comment.
Without any signal from the agency that there is a possibility that the agency may change its determination in the final? You're supposed to, so if the record happens to contain surrogate values for all six potential surrogate countries, because, and nobody's arguing about it at the moment, so Commerce has the ability to make a change in the final without any indication whatsoever of the possibility of making that change. And if the respondents in this case or petitioners in another case don't make anticipatory CYA arguments on the record, they have failed to your argument is they have failed to exhaust in that case. And, you know, Commerce has free rein to cherry pick whatever data it wants for a final, as long as it was already on the record. If nobody raised it, and they get a free pass at the court for failure to exhaust. That's the argument.
Well, Your Honor, no, I think that's extreme. I think the devil's in the details, right? So, using the court's hypothetical, if there was a record in which parties had. Interested parties have placed on the record surrogate values for all six of the listed countries, then yes, in terms of the preliminary review and between the preliminary and the final, the parties, it would have been incumbent on the parties to have taken a position with respect to which amongst those six had the best available, you know, satisfied the statutory criteria and had the best available information to measure whatever was the relevant inquiry, right? Whether it's primary surrogate or the surrogate valuation of a particular input. Having then done that, if Commerce takes those arguments and takes that data and draws a different conclusion, the parties have had their notice and their opportunity to comment.
Okay, I think you've changed around the hypothetical a little bit, but I think I get your point.
It's also, sorry, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
It is also a discretionary document for the court, right? And that's why, because this is a fact-based inquiry and the devil is in the details, right? Did the parties have notice? Did the parties have an opportunity to comment in the context of whatever is the specific change in practice at issue, right? And that's why there have been cases, I've had cases in front of Your Honor where Commerce has determined that we would not press an exhaustion argument because, you know, whatever an interested party said below, you know, reasonably preserve that issue. So I think it is fact dependent.
Okay. Is anything additional or specific to sub two that you wanted to flag as well?
So with respect to sub two, we do submit that Boomerang does support applying exhaustion to plaintiff respondent below's market share argument. Taking the criteria from Boomerang, right, respondents at the administrative level would have known that Commerce needed to select a primary surrogate country. They would have known or should have known that Malaysia and Romania were potential candidates. They knew or should have known that Malaysia was a prime candidate given its export volume and the fulsome data for surrogate valuation of the inputs that was on the record. They knew or should have known that Romania might have been a candidate. As respondents acknowledged in their surrogate country comments, Romania was a candidate. Its export volume was not as high as the other candidates. To the extent at that point, respondents, plaintiffs here, respondents below, intended to advocate for Commerce's selection of Romania as the primary surrogate country, it was incumbent upon them to shore up support for that finding of primary surrogacy and to put forth all of their evidence and arguments on that point. And we know that they knew this because they did make arguments in favor of Malaysia. They just focused on data quality. They didn't focus on all four of the statutory elements. And for that failure, exhaustion applies.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Mr. Khan?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. Just to start with Boomerang generally before bringing it down to our facts, Boomerang does not require exhaustion in the absence of a case brief argument requesting that Commerce change its methodology and conclusions in the final determinations. In that case, this court was found to have abused its discretion for excusing petitioners from exhaustion where the mandatory respondent, JESCO, raised a specific case brief issue. JESCO's case brief in the OCTG from Saudi Arabia investigation requested that Commerce use a different CV profit source in the final that it had in the prelim. Namely, JESCO wanted Commerce to use JESCO's own third country sales to Colombia, to Colombia, and petitioners in rebuttal objected. But they did not specifically argue that those sales would have been an inappropriate CV profit source because they were intra-company transfers. And so the issue was whether petitioners were specifically required to exhaust that point. The circuit reversed this court and said petitioners were obligated to exhaust that point because JESCO specifically made the request. JESCO put the issue in play. To quote from the Federal Circuit, in its case brief, JESCO suggested using those data.
Mr. Khan, why don't we get to the application of Boomerang in this case? I mean, the court has read Boomerang. The court is quite familiar with the Boomerang decision. Okay. The question is, how does it apply to this case?
Okay, Your Honor. Well, we submit that Boomerang strongly disfavors applying exhaustion doctrine here, okay? Because for Boomerang to have applied, petitioner's case brief would have to request that Commerce revisit its preliminary finding that Romania was a significant producer of comparable merchandise, right? So just to follow up on the defendants, you know, all the things that we knew or should have known, we had no reason to know or even suspect that Commerce would change its preliminary finding that Romania was a significant producer of comparable merchandise, right? Because the the preliminary decision memo analysis that I shared my screen said that all countries are significant producers. So why would we think that Commerce would do a 180 in the final and say, no, actually, Romania is not? What Boomerang stands for, and I apologize for my lengthy dissertation, I actually was involved in that case, so it's dear to my heart. But what happened there was the interested party put it in play. And that's exactly what defendant interveners here could have done. I'm going to share my screen and show you their case brief, okay? Or just the table of contents. Hold on. Can everyone see? Yeah. Can everyone see my screen? Okay. See, it's labeled a rebuttal brief, but it's really their case brief. And look, all they're arguing for is that the department should change their prelim findings to, in the final, apply partial AFA to carbon activated. There's nothing about, not asking for any changes to the surrogate country, and in particular, they're not challenging Commerce's finding that Romania was a significant producer of comparative merchandise. So we had no reason to anticipate Commerce would reverse course. We were not on notice of that potential, that Commerce would flip in the final and exclude Romania. So, you know, our market share argument in the briefing was unnecessary, unforeseen, and, you know, without any trigger in petitioner's case brief, Boomerang compels finding exhaustion unnecessary here. And for the same reason, I can stop sharing my screen now that I've made that point about petitioner's case brief, but I would like to emphasize that this court in AR-10 found that Boomerang didn't apply. Quote, Boomerang does not require parties to anticipate issues that have not been raised by a party or the agency until that point. I heard defendant concede that no party challenged the production. So with Commerce preliminarily saying they're all equal and no party challenging, how were we on notice? How are we supposed to anticipate that? This is a discretionary doctrine and it's based on fairness. We don't need to have a crystal ball and anticipate every permutation that Commerce might make in the final, only based on the prelim and based on what our adversary puts in play in the case brief. And we submit it would be totally unfair to deny us our chance to demonstrate based on the ROM carbon statement that Romania remained a significant producer. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Brewer, anything?
Thank you, Your Honor. The government's covered all the points that we intended to make, so for the sake of brevity, I won't repeat them.
Okay. Thank you. All right. Let's turn to bituminous coal. And I think we'll continue on with DOJ for A and B, and then I think for sub-question C really goes to an argument that the defendant intervenors made. So again, Ms. Finnan, let me pause for a moment before I cue you to go into 2A and see if there's anything further you wanted to say with regard to the Boomerang question. We can continue on.
Only with respect to the application to this case, plaintiff respondents below knew that Romania might have a significant production problem. Their surrogate country comments and their pre-preliminary comments refer to domestic production. They don't actually draw out an analysis, but
you're referring to their pre-preliminary comments, and in the preliminary mm-hmm. determination, Commerce said, yeah, we think they are, in fact, significant producers. Mm-hmm. And And that was the last statement from the agency before there was an expectation of exhaustion, or at least as being argued by the government here. So, I hear you. Okay, let's turn to coal.
Yes. Yeah, so, turning to question two concerning bituminous coal, the court asks a policy question of Commerce whether it applies the doctrine of waiver to arguments raised solely in footnotes. The answer is no. Commerce does not apply the doctrine of waiver to arguments raised solely in footnotes. But again, there's an important caveat, right? Waiver may still be appropriate for other reasons. regardless of whether an issue is raised in the narrative or a footnote, right? As would be the case when a party raises an argument or a summary conclusion without analysis, then whether that summary conclusion or argument without analysis was in the narrative or in a footnote, Commerce would still press exhaustion. And I have some case law examples of that, but I don't know that it's a controversial premise.
Okay. All right. Do you want to jump into B as well?
Sure. So, we skipped over little two.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead. All right. So,
So 2A little one asks about Commerce's policy with respect to footnotes and exhaustion. Little two asks whether Commerce declined to consider arguments on this basis. No, Commerce did not decline to consider the argument concerning Chapter 27 on the basis that it was raised in the party's footnote. Commerce addressed the issue in the Issues and Decision Memorandum at page 14, providing, quote, the record does not contain similar information with respect to the Malaysian imports under Chapter 27, and as such, there's no record evidence to support the use of Malaysian import surrogate value data under HS 2701.19. Commerce then proceeded in the same paragraph to refer,
they addressed what some could characterize as a legal argument on a factual basis, on a record yeah. evidence basis. All right. Yep. Okay. No, I understand the point.
So they did address they didn't ignore the issue solely because it was raised in a footnote, as say the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit might do.
Right.
They considered the issue. They just looked at it from a factual.
Okay. But did they ever address it from a legal basis? I mean, this is in a sense. I mean, flowing into question B. Then, I understand their position from a fact basis. The question is whether that position is consistent, in fact, with previous statements from the agency in terms of how it looks at the HS codes in other countries when trying to determine surrogate values.
Yeah, so I think Commerce was focused on a factual basis for it, but they're also saying that there was no evidence in the record, right? Plaintiffs, respondents, none of the interested parties had cited any law either for extension of the note, right? There was no law cited. There was no factual support offered. There was nothing there. And on that basis, Commerce rejected the argument. Turning to the court's question on bituminous coal part B, the court does, as Your Honor noted, point to another decision by Commerce at the administrative level that would seem to suggest that they extended the note, and a note applicable to one country under the HS code system, to that of another country. I would say in response only that what Commerce does in one review is not binding on what it may do in another. But even persuasiveness standpoint, I don't think that the polyethylene decision, to the extent it does extend a note from one country to another, is persuasive as far as application of a similar concept here. And that is because the analysis in polyethylene film doesn't sufficiently establish the extent of any controversy on that extension of the note, nor does it actually reason out why the note from one country was applied to another. That is to say that the administrative review in polyethylene film was conclusory in its extension of the note. And so without any kind of analysis,
your argument is that the agency does not recognize that the tariff schedule is in fact harmonized across the membership of the World Customs Organization, and that it's incumbent upon respondents in every case to make that argument as a legal argument and support it to the agency? I mean, come on. It's not limited to the case that I cited in the question. I mean, you can go back through. I mean, a number of other cases, whether you're talking about stilbenic optical brightening agents, where they talk about, you know, the harmonization at the 4 and 6 digit levels. You can talk, you know, you can look at, you know, other cases where, again, the same 6 digit prefix to products subject to international trade. I mean, they're recognizing it across the board. Why? What's different here that suddenly, you know, the agency can't apply something that's, you know, I mean, a legal concept that it's, you know, clearly aware of. You're saying now that as a, you know, that they can reject it on a factual matter, as a factual matter, because somebody didn't make the legal argument in front of them. I'm having a hard time with this one.
No, I'm not meaning to suggest that the harmonized schedule doesn't apply from country to country. I think Commerce at the administrative level had concern about application of a note that applied to one country, extending the application of that
evidence that the note in question applied only to Thailand, that this was a country-specific note as opposed to a note within the harmonized code?
I don't know that that was fully developed by the parties below.
I'm sorry, can you start your connection glitched for just a minute, and I missed the first part of your response to that.
My understanding of the record is that the note, the parties seem to assume the note applied clearly to one country, and the dispute was over whether or not it could extend to another country, either as a legal or factual matter.
You said the parties seem to assume this as opposed to the government?
The government assumed it, yes. I think my understanding of the arguments in the case is that the parties also assumed it, but then were making a case for its extension to another country. Maybe I have that wrong. I can't speak to what other parties were thinking about. But my understanding was that it was understood that it applied only to one country. The question was whether or not it applied to others as well.
Okay.
And in that regard, Commerce found that it didn't have enough evidence in front of it to make that deduction.
Okay. All right. Thank you. I think I understand your argument. Let's, Mr. Khan, are you taking up the mantle of coal as well?
Yes, Your Honor. This is the last question for which I will be taking primary responsibility before turning it over to my colleague. I can quickly address 2A, because I think we're on the same page as the government. I mean, this is not an instance where our entire substantive claim was in a footnote, right? We have pages of our brief devoted to the heading arguing for HTS 2701.19. The footnote had what we thought was an uncontroversial point, that HTS chapter notes are harmonized, right? And we cited to the this note in the record for Thailand, but it's a 6-digit note. It's talking about HTS 2701.12, and chapter notes are harmonized. That's just to the 6-digit level. That's axiomatic in the trade community. So, and Commerce just ignored that point. So we think there should be, at a minimum, a remand to address it. But and then turning to the next question, Commerce wanted the Malaysian note on the record. They were not satisfied, even though it was only to the 6-digit level. They were, and therefore internationally harmonized, they wanted the Malaysian note on the record, but this position can't be reconciled with the harmonized nature of the HTS system, where 6-digit headings and their chapter notes are harmonized across WCO countries, and it also violates Commerce.
Mr. Khan, you said yes. You seem to acknowledge that Commerce wanted the Malaysian note on the record. Is that request in the record? I mean, was there an explicit request from the agency?
No, there was not. But in their IDM, Your Honor, let me see if I can find it.
Oh, you're talking in terms of their conclusion.
That's right.
All right. Thank you.
Sure. And then, I mean, this brings us to PET from China, which, you know, Commerce used the chapter note on the record for South Africa HTS to value PET chip under the Indonesian HTS. And, you know, we object to the defendant's characterization a few minutes ago that the Commerce didn't reason out why it did it. It did reason out. It's in the IDM. Quote, the The system applies the same HTS six-digit products subject to international trade. And elsewhere, quote, the same HTS six-digit prefix is applicable to Indonesia and South Africa. So the rationale that is on that record, there's that precedent is entirely on point because that same six-digit prefix, 2701.12, applies to both Thailand and Malaysia. There's no distinction that would disfavor application of the principle here. The only difference that we can see is Commerce's preliminary pet chip valuation was supported by the HTS note, whereas Commerce's preliminary bituminous coal valuation was refuted by the HTS note. So, you know, what defendant is now saying, oh, well, it wasn't controversial. We see that as Commerce only extrapolating a note on the record from one country to another when it supports its own preliminary valuation. And that is just untenable agency action for which this court should order reconsideration in response to the final question.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Khan. Maybe we'll transition to you, Ms. Brewer, by giving you a broad opportunity, obviously, to speak to questions A or B, any of the subparts there. But if you could start off maybe with C, and that is, I mean, you made the argument in your brief about the pointing to a specific example of an additional U.S. note. Some, you know, I look at that and I was a little surprised because it almost seems to confirm the fact that, yes, there are circumstances when we have additional country-specific notes, but and in that sense, acknowledging the fact that there are other notes that are, in fact, not country-specific that are harmonized across the membership of the World Customs Union. So maybe you can speak to C and to the extent that you have additional points that you want to add with regard to A and B, help us out on that front as well.
Sure. Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to share my screen, so just bear with me for a moment, and I'll see if I can get this up. Are you able to see my Adobe page?
Not yet. It says that you are starting to share your content, but the content itself is not yet appearing, at least on my screen.
Okay. I am getting a little bit of a delay, so maybe it's just going to take a moment. What I'm trying to share is the page from the respondent's supplemental section D questionnaire response that actually discusses note 2 and references the Thai tariff schedule. So I'm hoping that will...
It's appearing now.
Okay, good. So I think it's helpful just to look at it in the context of this conversation. So this was the page that Commerce cited in the IDM, where it said that the information on the record about the particular breakouts for the coal subheadings were particular to Thailand. So you can see in the first place where I've highlighted here, please note that the Thai tariff under HTS 2701, and then it goes on to discuss it. And then I highlighted one more sentence towards the bottom of this page where it says in respondents questionnaire response, please refer to exhibit SD27 for the test report for smoke coal, as well as the Thai tariff extracts. So I show this to make the point that this is what Commerce was looking at when it reached its final results. And it was comparing this information provided in the respondents questionnaire response, as well as the attached Thai tariff schedule, to the statement in the footnote in respondent's brief that contained no citation, as the government has already pointed out. So this point gets to a little bit of the court's question in 2C, but it also goes to the 2B discussion as well. Part of the court's question directed to defense interveners in question 2C was, however, there is no indication that note 2 is specific to Thailand. So Commerce believes that there was, in fact, that information. So I would respectfully disagree with the premise of the court's question there. But I think that, you know, this is the page that Commerce cited to when making that finding. And I think it goes to the question there. And in terms of our citation to the additional notes in the United States schedule, I see in plaintiff's reply brief that they've extrapolated from that you can assume that there's uniformity across the notes for other countries. And we were making the point simply that there can be variations among countries and that the United States has added them. I don't know that you can then make the leap to assume that between all other countries, there would be no variation in the other notes. So, you know, I disagree with that argument, and that's not the point that we were making in our case brief.
Well, I mean, do you dispute the fact that Commerce has in other cases recognized that, in fact, the tariff schedule is harmonized at the 4- and 6-digit level?
I see those citations.
And let me just to bring it back to sort of what you're pointing to, what you're sharing your screen on. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's focused on at the 6-digit level where, again, Commerce has recognized the harmonization of the tariff code. That's the challenge that I'm trying to figure out here, is that they now seem to, you know, have again buried their head in the sand with regard to, you know, the harmonization that they have recognized in other cases.
Understood, Your Honor, and I'm not sure I can provide too much beyond what Ms. Finnan has already said. But my hope in responding to the court's question here was to point out what specific evidence Commerce was looking at here. I think the lack of a citation in respondent's case brief is notable. And, you know, I think Commerce at the time of issuing the final results was looking at this submission as what they had on the record of this proceeding. So that's sort of the best I can do in response to that question.
Okay.
And right. May I weigh in on one other aspect of
certainly
this issue? So I wanted to go back to its question 2B, little 2. Is there any reason why the court should not remand this issue for Commerce to reconsider or further explain in its decision? So I do think that, you know, as I've just mentioned, I do think that the court can uphold Commerce's decisions on the note 2 issue. But even if you put that aside as a threshold issue and you look at the substance of the classification of bituminous coal, the court can uphold that finding on the substance, certainly. So I think on the bituminous coal issue as a whole, remand is not necessary, even if the court cannot uphold the note 2 issue. And, you know, I know the court didn't ask any questions on the substance of the bituminous coal classification. We've discussed it in our brief, and I am prepared to walk through a few record documents to demonstrate why the court can uphold the substance of that classification. But if the court doesn't want to go that route, then I understand.
Well, I mean, I'll give you, I think, I mean, looking back through the evidence, I mean, this is, you know, the question here is, well, two things. One, before you walk me through anything, I'm not sure that it's really going to work because we're set up as a public argument here. We do have outside callers who've called into it, and so I don't know if you're
Judge Barnett.
Yes.
I'm very sorry to interrupt you. I can ask the outside parties to leave if need be.
My dad is just our interns. Public, Your Honor.
Sorry, I think Mr. McInerney, it was you that jumped in. Yes, thank you for muting again.
Yeah, I'm very sorry. I can ask them to leave if necessary.
I understand. I think we may have other members of the public, though, as well.
My documents are all public. I pulled up the public versions of everything, so I would not be discussing anything proprietary.
Okay, I'm not sure that would help resolve anything then, because I think, I mean, the one question here is, I mean, as I think about the factual question, and I think this is one where, you know, the two may be related to one another. I mean, if there's a lack of clarity in terms of the appropriate category, the appropriate HTS code for the coal, whether we're talking about, you know, in terms of the kilocals per kg. You know, there's both the question of sort of what's the right category to be under, what's the right, you know, HTS code number to be under, and also whether the record is clear in terms of what the kilocal per kg content was for the input that was being utilized in this case, and whether there is clarity across the board. I mean, I think I understand that argument. And And in the absence of additional clarity on it, I mean, I'm not sure that, you know, it may be something that the agency at the end of the day is going to have to reconcile if they also have to further address the proper HS code. So I think I have the issue. I mean, unless there's something specific that you think I, based on that effort to address the question without getting too much into the weeds and particularly the potential BPI, unless there's something you think that I could benefit from, I think we could move on. But go ahead.
Okay. I'll make 1 minute of comments on that.
Certainly.
So again, I would just go back to, you don't have to remand the entire bituminous coal issue if you find that note 2 would apply, because Commerce very clearly in the IDM said, you know, we're valuing under 270112. And, you know, on the record of this administrative review are the surrogate value memo sections from AR 4 through 10, which show that Commerce has uniformly valued bituminous coal using 270112. So to do what respondents are asking here would be quite a deviation from how bituminous coal has been valued in the past proceedings. You know, out of the concern of potentially diving into BPI, I won't say too much more, except that what Commerce cited as support for its decision in the IDM at page 14, where it said that there was not evidence that the bituminous coal raw material input should be valued under 270119, they cite to the DJAC SDQR at 7 and 8. Plaintiffs also cite to page 32 of that submission in their opening brief for the proposition of what the calorific value would be that would allow their bituminous coal to be valued under 270119. And if you look at those pages and you look at the exhibits that support those pages, for the reasons that are discussed in the proprietary sections of the briefs, the evidence does not support their claim. And even if you look at, it's in their DOC brief at page 28, note 42, they actually use the exhibits they cite to calculate what they say the calorific value is. It's not actually in those documents. It had to be derived. So I'll end there. My point, Your Honor, is just that I think you can uphold the bituminous coal issue on the merits, even if you find that you can't uphold it on the note 2 issue. And thank you for entertaining my comments on that.
Right. Okay. Thank you. Mr. Khan, anything further you want to say on this issue?
Yes, very briefly. If I may share my screen once more, I just want to, let's see if I can. Okay, you guys, this is our CAC's supplemental questionnaire exhibit SD27 that we signed.
Can you make it a little bit larger? Because the way you have your screen set up, even on my big monitor,
hold on. Let me move it over. Let me move it over to my,
okay.
Let's see. Hold on. I'm going to have to.
Oh, that's just, that's just the tie note that you're putting up.
Well,
right?
I just wanted to show
that. I've looked at that. I mean.
Oh, okay. Okay. Then I'll stop sharing. Basically, I was just trying to draw the attention to the fact that, there wasn't, in other words, I heard petitioners as saying, all we're doing is in our response saying that was the tie rule, whereas we put that on the record. So I just want everyone to be clear that the note's on the record. With respect to petitioner's points that, well, putting the note aside, you can still affirm, as Your Honor is well aware, you can only affirm for what the agency has said. So beside the note issue, they just said, well, we didn't show that we made a, quote, sub-bituminous call that would be covered by point 19. There was no unpacking, no explanation, no citation to the evidence of or anything to suggest why our call had some use requirement to qualify for that. And so and in fact, Justice didn't even address that argument in its response brief. So we don't see how there's any way that Your Honor can affirm the Commerce's decision on bituminous coal. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Ms. Finnan or Ms. Brewer, anything further on coal? Sorry, on coal, right.
Just on behalf of the government, we would echo Ms. Brewer's comments.
for defendant intervener with regards to affirming on the merits, even if Your Honor has some issues with the note 2 analysis.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, let's turn to coal tar pitch. Another issue that has been litigated in several of these administrative reviews. One might wonder at some point, everybody would get the point that let's be really clear what we're talking about here. These questions, I think, are in the first instance directed to plaintiffs, I think. We'll start with Mr. Chaudhary.
Yes. Good morning, Your Honor. This is once again Dharmendra Chaudhary for plaintiffs and plaintiff interveners. I will address coal tar pitch argument. And Your Honor's first question is whether our argument in support of HTS 2706 is based on an assumption. I would submit it is not based on an assumption. It is based on substantial record evidence, and I'm going to elaborate those substantial record evidence. But before that, the court is already well aware about this input from AR-10 litigation. And the input involved in this proceeding is not different from what was decided upon in AR-10. The court is also aware that this input is known by several names, and that is at the core of the problem, as Your Honor alluded, surrounding this. It seems as if it's an esoteric input. It is not. It is one of the very commonly used input in industry, commonly used chemical. The problem is that it is known in common and commercial parlance by at least three names. Those three names are coal tar pitch, and pitch. And both respondent and Commerce Department, including in this proceeding, have conflated these names. I mean, they keep on interchangeably using different names to describe the same input. So I wanted to lay it down, and likewise, even in the scientific literature, which is a plethora of them we have placed on the record, they also keep on interchangeably using these names. So, right.
I mean, I think I understand that point. And I think the issue, I mean, you've flagged, I mean, in a sense, this sort of collapses all these, A and B here, but the issue is in AR-10, they ended up focusing on the actual pitch content and used that as a way of distinguishing. And you're saying, well, they should be, you know, they've got to be stuck with that. Well, there at the same time, there seems to be some advancement of the issue change in the issue to the extent that the record developed more was developed more fully in this case, where in addition to looking at pitch content, there was also the manner of production, whether it's through distillation or as a byproduct, and that there seemed to be additional facts that the agency took into account here that they did not take into account in AR-10. And so then you get into the whole host of precedent that's out there that says, you know, obviously, particularly in a factual matter, that the finding in one segment of the proceeding is not necessarily binding on subsequent segments of the proceeding. Again, where facts are at issue. And so, I mean, here you have, clearly, I think, a combination of facts and it's not exactly law, but I mean, correct understanding of the HTS. So with that, I mean, if I could ask you to, you know, focus on the questions. I mean, I think I understand the issue. I mean, I'm really trying to get at where we are in terms of the record here.
Yes. Thank you, Your Honor, for distilling it down to this. So in the IDM, the Commerce used basically two rationales to determine that this input is classified under 270810. Commerce first said that the respondents, and they cited our brief to state that we have acknowledged that this input is also commonly known in industry as pitch. I mean, this was a forthright disclosure from our side to not to admit that our input was pitch, But to allay any kind of doubt hanging around that, you'd, as Your Honor rightly pointed out in AR-10 opinion also, that the key to resolution of this input is not what the title is attached by respondents or other parties to this input, but what is the essential character? What is the chemical composition underlying this input? That becomes the key factor. And to Your Honor's point, so that was the first thing. Department said that you respondents themselves say that their input is also known as pitch in the industry. And second, they said that on this record, there is evidence to show that coal tar pitch is produced from coal tar by a distillation process. These are the two rationales which the department advanced to pigeonhole our input under 270810 instead of 2706. So to rewind it, let us first focus on what is the record evidence in support of the chemical composition of coal tar pitch input utilized by respondents in AR-11. On this record, and on Monday, we submitted a supplemental joint appendix where we submitted record evidence for both of the respondents, CAC and DJAC. CAC is one of the plaintiffs here. In CAC's supplemental response exhibit SD6 and DJAC's supplemental questionnaire response exhibit SD53, the coal tar test reports are provided. These coal tar test reports provide the pitch content of coal tar pitch used by the two respondents. And without going into BPI, I can tell you that I can affirm that the pitch content in these test reports are in the same range as the pitch content which was the subject matter of AR-10 litigation. Broadly speaking, and there is plenty of record evidence, I'm not violating any BPI, this range can be said to be somewhere between, let's say, 55 to 70-75%. That is the range, both in AR-10 and in AR-11 litigation. So that is the pitch, that is the input we are talking about. Coal tar pitch, which contains, whose single most predominant constituent is pitch, and which ranges in a broad range between 55 to 75%. The balance is a tiny bit of moisture, and the remaining 30 to 40% is comprised of a variety of oils, light oil, middle oil, and heavy oil. This is what this input is about. Now, on this record, and I'm going to share my screen now, but before that, let me explain that coal tar pitch input is produced by a distillation of coal in the coke making process. Coal tar or coal tar pitch is one of the byproducts. And there is record evidence showing that as it is generated as a byproduct, coal tar or coal tar pitch already contains 50 and up to 60% of pitch. It is already contained. And thereafter, this input can be subjected to further distillation processes in tar workshops where this pitch content is enriched. And this enrichment can happen, let's say, from 60% to 75% to 80%. And up to finally, if you fully distill it, you reach 100%. When it reaches 100%, at that point, it is a pure pitch. It then becomes a pure pitch. But within this range, between 60 to, let's say, 80 or 90%, the coal tar pitch is an enriched coal tar pitch. And it is produced by a partial distillation process of coal tar. So before moving, let me share my screen to show something very important. Sorry, I have a number of documents open on my screen. I hope I am pulling the right one.
Okay. It doesn't seem to be working. Do you have the tab number from the appendix?
I'm sorry. There's a bit of a problem. Just bear with me. I'm coming.
This is why we have the practice session here. If you have the document number, the court can, I can pull it up. I have access to the record.
One second.
Mr. Chaudhary, do you have the document number?
No, I have prepared a binder actually for exactly this purpose. One second. Is my screen visible now?
Somewhat.
Is the first page Carbon Activated TNG Company Limited? Okay. This is the screen. I am sorry for this trouble.
Well, you've got a blackout box in the middle of it all too, though.
Yes, I wanted to share this page. Can you see it reads technology for producing?
Yes.
Okay. So the third paragraph here, coal tar pitch is the large tonnage product of processing coal tar. Its yield is up to 60% of tar. And this is a very important public domain information, which shows that coal tar pitch, as it arises from as a byproduct, the initial input, for tar workshops, coal tar pitch is the input. And this coal tar pitch originally contains 60% of pitch. And the source of this report is one of the most authoritative CIS coal tar pitch report, which is focused on coal tar pitch input itself. So I wanted to point to this.
Mr. Chaudhary, this is information. This is all part of your brief. I have a fairly specific question that I'm hoping you'll get to momentarily.
Yeah.
And that is, the issue is, and I understand the question. We have a problem of terminology, that there is a loose use of the terminology in the industry. There's an inconsistent use of the terminology, both in the industry and then in the reporting and then to some degree by the agency. You have issues that arose in AR-10. The agency focused on pitch content in that case. Here they added into that a consideration of the distillation process. The question is fairly direct, and that is your assumption that it should have been, that they should have used 2706, undermined by the fact that there's also evidence here that this was produced through a distillation process that we're talking about, which is, for which there is some evidence, there's some indication that when you're talking about coal tar or coal tar pitch produced through distillation, that there's a possible that perhaps you should be looking at 2708.10. That's the question. If you could get to that specific question, that would be helpful.
Yes, Your Honor. But before that, Your Honor,
there's no more before that. I've read your briefs. I understand some of the arguments. I've looked at the evidence. I've looked at your exhibits here. Okay. Here's where this is the question I'm trying to get to. What's wrong with the agency having factored in that additional consideration and looked at that and said, well, here we actually have evidence that what they're talking about is product produced through a distillation process. Maybe it makes sense for us in this case now to be looking at 2708.10 rather than 2706.
Okay, Your Honor. The answer to it, the most direct answer to this lies in DJAC's test report, which is at Exhibit ST53 of what we submitted on this Monday. In that—
But the test report goes to the pitch content. It doesn't, it was the issue about the distillation process.
No, there is one, a very important additional metric on that test report, which I wanted to bring to Your Honor's attention. On that test report, besides the actual pitch content, there is an additional minimum requirement of pitch, which is needed for coal tar pitch input. And that minimum requirement of pitch is below 60%. What that means is that, and let me put a number, although that is not the right number, it is about 50%. So any coal tar pitch which contains 50% or more pitch content that is suitable to be used as a coal tar pitch input in the production of activated carbon. And the public domain information which I just showed, the coal tar as it arises as a byproduct of coke production process, that already contains up to 60% pitch. And DJAC's test report shows that a coal tar pitch sample, the minimum requirement of pitch is only about 50%. It is less than 60%. So coal tar pitch input as it arises originally without any further distillation process, it is already suitable to be used in the production of activated carbon. And in this proceeding, both the inputs used by CAC and DJAC, they have overlapping pitch content, slightly below 60% going up to
in the same
neighborhood. Now to your next question as to there is record evidence in this case, and again, Your Honor is familiar with that Exhibit 5K where there is a flow chart, and it is, I can share the screen also.
It's not necessary. Yep.
But Your Honor is aware about it already. That coal tar pitch which is on that flow chart, that references an enriched coal tar pitch. When coal tar pitch is subjected to further distillation to obtain a higher pitch content, less than 100%, because if it reaches up to 100%, then it becomes pitch, pure pitch. But below 100% pitch, it remains a coal tar pitch. The same term, coal tar pitch, is used for whether it contains 60% or whether it contains 90%. But coal tar pitch, as it originally is produced as a byproduct, it already contains 60% pitch. And I have demonstrated, the record evidence shows that a coal tar pitch containing 60% pitch is already suitable to be used as an input by both the respondents. Therefore, the record evidence already shows that coal tar pitch, as it is known in commercial parlance, that is the input which is covered in 270600, because 270600 is described as coal tar produced from tar distilled from coal, from lignite, or from peat. That is the description of 270600. And the record shows that tar, as it produced from coal, it already contains 60% pitch. And the record also shows that even if the pitch content is slightly less than 60%, it is still suitable to be used as an input in the production of activated carbon by the two respondents. So therefore, you do not need to further enrich it to go anywhere. The input in this case is already covered in 270600 without us relying upon explanatory notes or anything. But explanatory note is definitely helpful to further illuminate on the classification of enriched coal tar.
Right, which gets us to question B. So let's focus on that. Where can you point out where this argument was presented about the explanatory note was presented to the agency?
We did not. We did okay. not at that time. Because
if you didn't, what basis should the court take the argument into consideration, if at all?
Yes, Your Honor. So explanatory notes, as Your Honor is aware, they explain the scope of HTS headings. They are issued by World Customs Organization, and they are an international legal reference. They are preeminent tools of interpretation for classification, and preeminent interpretation tools for classification purposes. They are akin to a dictionary, just as you refer to a dictionary to get a meaning of a term. So it is a manual or a dictionary issued by an international World Customs Organization. And this court, it is very important, and they are publicly available and judicially noticeable. This court in several proceedings has applied World Customs Organization HSN notes without any indication that they were argued before the underlying agency. And I am going to share my screen to show you at least two customs cases.
These are the two that you forwarded to the court earlier today?
Yes.
Along with, yes, okay.
Altered products.
I'm aware. I mean, Fujitsu and what was the other? And,
yes.
Right.
Yes.
Yep. Okay.
So I will just read the relevant line. The court may look to the explanatory notes. That is a key finding there. And in Fujitsu America, the court said the court may look to the explanatory notes to the HTSUS for guidance in interpreting the HTSUS.
Okay.
And before that, in our reply brief, we had cited to this court's opinion in a trade case, San Mao, where the court said that as a legal reference on the interpretation of GIRs and HS nomenclature, including scope of headings and HTS subheadings, explanatory notes are essentially no different than any other legal reference, such as a statute.
Okay. I think I get the gist of your point on this, Mr. Chaudhary. Let's give the government an opportunity to respond. Ms. Finnan?
Yes, Your Honor. Just with respect to the last two cases mentioned by Mr. Chaudhary, the Otter case and Fujitsu, we received those about an hour before argument. I had an opportunity to look at them briefly. Both of them, well, I'll take them each in turn. Otter provides that notes can be a guide and are not legally binding. In any event, there was no statutory construction type argument ever made by respondents in the administrative proceedings, so we would argue that there's a failure to exhaust. And it's not purely a legal question in terms of invoking an exception to exhaustion, because as the Fujitsu case references, it's only a purely legal question if there's no genuine dispute regarding what the merchandise is or its use. And here, as the last 20 minutes or so indicate, there clearly is a dispute regarding what actual merchandise, what actual input was at issue here. Was it coal tar? Was it coal pitch? Was it something in the middle? So this is not a purely legal question of law that would qualify for any exception to the exhaustion argument.
Okay. Anything you wanted to say with regard to the question A as well? I mean, the specific about distillation versus the production process?
No, I think we address all of that in our briefs.
Okay. Thank you. Ms. Brewer, anything?
I just want to add one quick comment, Your Honor. And I'm looking at the distillation flow chart that everyone has seen multiple times. And if I understand correctly, Respondents' Counsel said that although coal tar pitch is noted only once in that flow chart, there can be something like multiple levels of coal tar pitch or a prior level of coal tar pitch before the distillation. And I apologize if I'm not paraphrasing that very well, but my point is simply that that comment is reflected absolutely nowhere in the chart, which pretty clearly shows that in step two, there's a product called coal tar, and then after a distillation process at 400 degrees Celsius, you get three co-products, one of which is coal tar pitch. So I would just submit that the actual chart does not support the argument that there are different types of coal tar pitch or different levels in the way that respondents are arguing. That was all I wanted to add.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Okay, let's go on to the question sub C, the arguments with regard to aberrancy and the focus on Spanish exports, whether this argument's been exhausted. Mr. Chaudhary?
Yes, Your Honor. This specific argument regarding Spanish data was not raised. We did not raise it before Commerce.
Why should I consider it?
Yes. But we did raise the argument that the Malaysian data under 270600 was aberrant with respect to all other potential surrogate countries, all other six surrogate countries. But we did not cite to the particular Spanish data at that time. And Your Honor has raised that TrustCam ruling, whether it is prejudicial to our position. In TrustCam, the court said that by bringing up a general issue, a plaintiff has not necessarily exhausted all specific issues under that general umbrella. But the court then continued. And if Your Honor wants, I can share the screen to show.
It's not necessary. Yeah.
The court said, the court made a very important ruling after that in that same footnote. The determinative question is whether commerce was put on notice of the issue, not whether plaintiff's exact wording below is used in the subsequent litigation.
Here, of course, Trust Chem is before Boomerang as well, which sort of put an even finer point on this issue that you can't take, you don't get two bites at the apple. If you raise a, if you raise an argument to the agency, you know, you've got to cover the territory that relates to the argument that you're making. I mean, I know I cited Trust Chem in this question, but I mean, Boomerang is also, you know, relevant precedent that the court's going to have to take into consideration.
Yes, Your Honor. But there is a very important nuance which I wanted to point out, that in this case, this particular evidence occupies no more than one half page of one page. When the department looked at 270600 data and 270810 data, those were in the totality occupying one page only. And the department, when it looked at those data, it necessarily also looked at the partner countries' data from Spain under both the headings. So when we made that aberrant point with respect to 270600 and the anomaly and the fact that the two data were inter se anomalous, that 270810 was lower than 270600, the department has before it that one page data, and the department therefore was, the data was noticed by the department. It was before the agency.
So that's not the issue. The issue is whether you've exhausted your argument.
We did not, but the department was
and the other part of the question is there a reason for the court to apply an exception to the exhaustion doctrine?
And on that, my submission is that yes, because no further development of the record was not buried within 100 pages that we had to specifically point to a particular data point. This comprised only one page, and the data was looked at by the department. The department is admitting that it looked at the data and then made its finding to move from 270600 to 270810. And these data points were two or three line items in that. So the department was not, it cannot be fairly said that the department was not aware of the data, even though we did not specifically point to Spanish data per se.
Okay. Ms. Finnan, do you want to, your response?
Just briefly, Your Honor, the United States believes that this is a clear case for a failure to exhaust. Respondents below made arguments before Commerce that the data was anomalous for other reasons, did not ever raise the idea of the Spanish exports in AUVs. For that reason, they have not exhausted this issue. It's clearly a fact-based or mixed fact and law question, so it wouldn't qualify as a pure question of law, so there's no exception. It would be unduly prejudicial to the Department of Commerce for the court to consider it in the first instance now in court.
Okay. And I would assume that you dispute the idea that there's an obviousness exception to the exhaustion doctrine.
Absolutely, Your Honor. I think the law is pretty clear that there are limited exceptions, and obviousness has never been cited as one of them.
Okay. Ms. Brewer, anything you wanted to add on this?
I was just going to add, but it's now already been mentioned, that this, I think the facts of this issue are quite similar to Boomerang. So I think Boomerang pretty squarely applies here.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Let's move on to financial ratios, and we'll start there with Ms. Finnan. I mean, this is one of those. I mean, I get the idea. Each review is distinct and so on. But you know, at the same time, you know, we've got this problem that on the financial ratio side, we, you know, in AR-10, I think it was, sent it back, and upon closer examination, the agency came up with a different result. What about here? Where are we at? You want to address question A?
Yes, Your Honor. So as we argued in our brief, defendant has submitted that Commerce's determination in AR 11 is supported by substantial evidence. Of course, since that brief was filed, the court, there was a remand back to Commerce. There's been a remand redetermination. It's gone back to the court. There's been a second remand redetermination as the issues narrowed. We have gone back and compared the AR 10 and AR 11 records on this issue, and they're not, at least to which I'm presently aware, not distinguishing features that would warrant a different result in this case. than in AR-10. So to the extent the court is inclined to rule with respect to flaws in the adjustments in AR-11 as it ruled in AR-10, then a remand on that issue would be appropriate.
Thank you. I don't know that we need to go any further with it. I don't know that anybody else is going to. Mr. Chaudhary, do you want to take exception to that?
Absolutely not. They are admitting it's a cut and dried issue.
Right. Okay. I mean, does that apply? I mean, Ms. Finn, does that apply with respect to the indirect labor as well? Because it strikes me that could be different. So let me just make sure I understand the scope of your statement in response to sub-question A.
I think, Your Honor, I would if the court's going to remand with respect to adjustments made to the financial ratios and Commerce on remand were to make different adjustments than it's previously made, I don't want to hamstring what Commerce may do or how numbers relate to each other. I mean, I'm not warranting that Commerce would reopen the record or take new arguments or anything, but I think if they're going to look at the financial ratio calculations again, they would look at them in some.
In all aspects. Okay. Yeah. No, fair enough. All right. I assume Mr. Chaudhary is not going to have any qualms with that.
No, not at all.
Okay. Ms. Brewer might have a slightly different position, but I'll give you a chance if you want to say something on that front. But
sure. I'll note that there are factual differences for the social contributions and meal tickets line item, as well as the adjustments of investment property. Whether we make those arguments here before Commerce in the context of a remand, I don't know that it necessarily matters at this point. But for the sake of the record, I'll note there are distinctions there, and particularly for labor, because Commerce used a different source for the labor surrogate value here. And there's a clear distinction between this review and AR-10 as to whether these types of line items were included in that value. So again, that's, you know, the court is welcome to rule on that, but we can also make that argument before Commerce if it's going to reconsider the financial statement issue.
Okay. Thank you. I know I promised at the beginning then, I mean, at this point we've gone through the questions. I did indicate if anybody thought they had additional arguments that they needed to make or didn't have a chance to address, that I'd give you that opportunity now. I'm not sure that anybody, you know, I mean, we've been going for almost an hour and three quarters, so hopefully we've gotten everything out, but I will stick to my the premise with which we started here and in the first instance ask plaintiffs if they have anything further they want to address.
I do not. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Mr. Khan. Mr. Chaudhary?
Yes, only one point, Your Honor, which remained to be addressed, and this is straight from your question. The department in its preliminary results kind of confused this total issue of coal tar and coal tar pitch. It said in its surrogate value memo, PDF, that it was using 2706 and 270810, both of the headings, both of the HTS two value, coal tar and coal tar pitch. Its accompanying Excel worksheet, however, mentioned only 270600.
Right.
And our argument against 270810 was limited to classification because we felt that it was not necessary to go beyond that. We believe we fairly exhausted on that point when the department had not even used that heading. And therefore, we limited to hitting out 270810 on the point of
classification. Yeah, but the problem is whether there was a mistake in what Commerce referred to in its preliminary analysis memo in referencing the was it 2708.10. The issue is, you know, and without actually using it, I mean, the issue is you raised arguments about it, and so that puts you in the boomerang context, and that is once you're going to go address a particular surrogate value, well, you know, you don't get to hold back on particular arguments and raise them in the first instance with the court. I mean, if you're going to attack the department's use of a classification, an HTS code for purposes of surrogate valuation, well, you got to make all your arguments to the agency. You can't hold them back. Federal Circuit has spoken fairly clearly on that point, and you haven't really explained to me why I should, you know, why that finding doesn't apply here. So, I mean, I appreciate your point. I mean, I did understand the issue with respect to Commerce's error, if you will, in the prelim and how and what it referred to in the memo versus what it actually used in the calculations. I understand that well. I mean, the problem is that you're stuck with what you raised in your case briefs to the agency. So, okay, but I understand that point. Okay. All right, Ms. Finnan, anything further from the government?
Nothing further from the government, Your Honor.
Okay, and Ms. Brewer.
The only closing comment I'll make, Your Honor, is just to circle back on the bituminous coal issue, because we feel quite strongly that the court can uphold Commerce's substantive finding there on the classification, even if the court finds that Commerce's findings with respect to note two are not supported by the record. So I'll just make one more plug for the court to uphold Commerce's substantive classification based on the fact that the evidence that the respondents provided and that Commerce cited in the IDM, in particular DJAC supplemental question D response, do not support changing how Commerce has classified bituminous coal for the last six reviews. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Thank you, everyone, for your preparation for today. Been very helpful. And you know, we'll continue our work on this issue and try to get a decision out as soon as possible. Look forward to the day when I know there's obviously a convenience factor that we can all do this without getting up at O dark 30 to hop on a plane or a train to New York City to all gather together. But you know, whether we meet in person, in DC or New York as well. I think it's, the idea of getting back to doing some of these proceedings, at least in person, is one I suspect that we all look forward to in one way or another. So until that time comes, though, be safe, stay healthy, and we'll take this under advisement. All right.
You,
take care, everybody. Enjoy the beautiful day.
Enjoy the beautiful day outside.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ron.
Thanks, Ron.
Thank you.
Have a good day.
All right. Bye-bye.